In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
On Thursday of this week, President Trump signed an executive order aimed at weakening the enforcement of the Johnson Amendment. Johnson as in then-Senator, later President Johnson. This is a law that bars churches and pastors from discussing political candidates or engaging in other political activities. Although that executive order itself raises a bigger issue, who do you want involved in politics? Christians in your community? Or a billionaire working in the shadows who's never even been to your community, who, through his hundreds of millions of dollars, can tilt the vote in your community and in your state through paid organizers, paid lawyers, paid protesters, and paid professional agitators? That's the focus of today's show. Well, one focus anyway. The billionaires working in the shadows to force their anti-American views on America. In particular, George Soros. If you heard last week's show, you heard about Senate Bill 719A, which has been called Oregon's gun confiscation bill. That did indeed pass the Senate, and it is headed to the House, where it is also likely to pass before heading off to the governor, and she has already said that she will sign it. That bill was passed thanks in large parts to the efforts of the anti-gun lobby, and they are paid for by George Soros, along with the help of other people like Michael Bloomberg, you know, the billionaire mayor out of New York City who sees extra-large sodas as dangerous as guns. Soros also pays heavily into far-left environmental causes. As we have said here on iSpy, healthcare is how the left controls people, the environmental movement is how the left controls industry and corporations. On today's show, we're going to start out talking about the potential sale of the Elliott State Forest, which is in the Coast Range northeast of Coos Bay. Before we get going, if you're near a computer, head to iSpyRadio.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a link to our Take Action page. Head there now, because if you are for common sense use of our state lands, you'll want to take action. After Dr. Zyback, we'll be talking George Soros with Ron Arnold, who for the last two decades has tracked the money on the left, and Soros in particular. Did I mention that one of Soros's former staff members told Ron all about Soros's operations? Yeah, you'll want to stick around for that. Up first, I'd like to welcome Dr. Zyback. He's got a PhD from the Oregon State University Environmental Sciences Program. His specialties include forest sciences, cultural anthropology, public education, and his academic focus was on environmental sciences education. And Bob, it's been a long time, it seems, but welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
So in the news right now is this plan to sell the Elliott Forest, and there's been a lot of back and forth in terms of the rightness or the wrongness of it. Why don't you fill us in and kind of give us a 30,000-foot view of the current situation?
Okay. The Elliott Forest is established specifically for school funds, and that's the way it operated for 30 or 40 or 50 years. And then in the 90s, the spotted owl and marbled murrelet problems started arising. And then about 2010, it reached such a point that logging was essentially made illegal as set up on the Elliott, and so it lost money, and it's lost money on average over the last 5 years.
Are
so
we talking a large amount of money or just kind of little insignificant ones?
Well, it's millions of dollars, but $2 and $3 and $5 million, and it should be making 15 or 20 or 25 million. So yeah, it's a difference of 20 or 25 million a year between wow, potential income and actual income.
Wow.
So the decision was made to sell it. But then the sales restrictions were really odd. Over 50 people were going to bid on it. Then the restrictions were such that only a single bid came in. And it was for a fixed rate. It was only $220 million. And it's estimated that there's at least $600 or $800 million in standing board feet of timber on the land. And then there's the value of the land. So we're selling $800 million or maybe even $1 billion worth of land and timber that was supposed to be set aside for a school fund to a single bidder
yeah,
at a fixed rate. So
who is it that they are planning to sell to?
Lone Rock put in the sole bid, and they formed some kind of partnership with the Cow Creeks. So that's the single bid. And because the price is so low, there's been a lot of upset about it. The environmental groups had plenty of chance to put in their own bid, but didn't. So that's where we're at.
Well, and so what are they planning to do with the land if they are able to acquire it? Are they going to take the timber off, or what are they looking at doing?
You mean Lone Rock?
Yes.
Or the state?
Lone Rock
has 10 years, and they've got to set aside, I think, 25% of the older trees. They've got to open up half the land to recreation. They've got to have 10 full-time direct and indirect jobs. But they've got artificial buffers along the creeks, and it's assumed that a lot of the current regulations, endangered species regulations, will still be in effect.
Well,
that's the reason the price is so low.
Well, aside from the economics of it, is there anything else that is especially concerning to you about just outright selling it to this group?
Well, I've been for privatization of government lands for decades, but selling it at a fixed rate, at such a low fixed rate, I think is unfair to the schools. Plus, I think we have a real opportunity to gain a lot of value, not only from the timber, but from the Elliott itself.
Hmm. What do you mean by that, by the Elliott itself?
Well, our proposal, the Giese Plan proposal, is for a 20-year educational effort on the Elliott, in which the riparian areas would be managed separately, and then the forested areas would be divided up by sub-basin between wildlife advocates and the law, school fund.
Okay.
And so
for
a 20-year period.
Actually, let's hold off on discussing that, because that's going to take quite a bit to go through. We'll talk about that in the next segment.
Okay.
In terms of the current sale, it's just come out recently that Governor Kate Brown is all of a sudden getting kind of hesitant about this. Do you have any ideas why?
Well, I think she listened a lot to groups of people who are really concerned about selling state land. This is our first state forest, and it's been very productive through the years. So there's a concern, and I think she reconsidered. And at the last meeting, February 14th, she proposed that the state put out a $100 million bond and essentially purchase part of the forest from itself, and then manage that for wildlife.
We only got about a minute here with you in this segment. Secretary of State Dennis Richardson is also suddenly interested in that. Do you have any idea why he's suddenly gotten on board?
Well, I think people are looking at the numbers. The numbers are so low for the sale, and then it's such a final decision, and it's going to raise a lot of legal issues. So I think they're reconsidering that strategy.
Huh. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the Giese Plan that Bob alluded to earlier. It is a plan that could actually make environmental sense, yes, even here in Oregon. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Bob Zybak, and his specialties are forest sciences, cultural anthropology, and public education. Talking about the plan to sell the Elliott Forest, which is over on the west, really on the coastal areas there of Oregon. And we touched a little bit briefly in the previous segment about the Giese Plan. And this is something that's been around for a while. Why don't you recap that for us again?
Okay. Wayne Giese is 97 years old, and for the last 30 years he's been proposing that the government lands in Oregon, specifically the federal lands, be divvied up between environmental factions and making jobs and products for American people, the main mission of the forests, and that riparian areas be managed separately. So this idea would be to resolve the timber wars, and so there'd be something for everybody, recreational use, bird habitat, jobs.
Hmm. And from what I can see, it is a truly common sense plan. As you say, it marries a lot of the interests of Oregonians here. Oregonians like their forests, and rightfully so. We also like to cut them down, and rightfully so, because you may generate an awful lot of money for that. And as we discussed in the previous segment, the Elliott Forest was established as part of the Common School Fund. These are state lands that are supposed to be generating income for the schools. And so why don't you talk to us a little bit about some of the income and the jobs that would be created as part of this plan?
Okay, the Elliott is all second growth forest, very young trees. It all burned up in 1868. But the cutting schedule in the 1980s was about 50 million board feet a year. That's 500 direct and indirect jobs as opposed to 10 from the sale. So that's a lot of rural jobs, local jobs for Coos County and Douglas County. It would also generate $460 million, according to state economists, over a 20-year period. Hmm. So if we had this plan implemented for a 20-year period, we would pull in twice as much as we would for a sale. We would still own the land. It would be 100% open to recreation, and it would be a perfect opportunity to do a comparison between different management approaches.
Hmm. And the way that the plan works, and we'll link this PDF up on iSpyRadio.com, just look in the show resources section. And what it does is it takes the 80,000-some acres of the Elliott State Forest, it divides it into sub-basins, between 24 and 30 of them, and each one of those would be anywhere between 1,000 and 5,000 acres. But then each of those sub-basins, the 24 to 30 of them, fall into one of two categories. One is an active forest management for maximum common school fund income, as described by law. And then the other category would be old growth wildlife habitat with a focus on the various endangered species that are there. Again, I think this is so common sense. I mean, it addresses both interests. And you're talking about an area of Oregon, especially in terms of the income side of things. I mean, these are counties that have been devastated by the cutbacks in the timber industry.
Coos Bay is importing timber from Canada.
Yeah, how absurd
right
is
now.
That?
Yep, it's the old Coles to Newcastle thing. It's we've had the forest shut down, the federal and state forests, and privatizing them is a good opportunity. But if that's going to be done, it should be done at a high bid. Highest bid. It shouldn't be at a fixed rate, and it should be an open market, but there's no reason to sell it. And here's an opportunity with modern internet communications to monitor the two different management approaches over time by our school kids and our teachers and our professors, and to see what the actual results of management are as far as wildlife populations, income, aesthetics, and so on.
Yeah. Well, and it not only allows for the creation of jobs, but for those that want to, you know, do ecotourism and whatnot, it sounds like they can go in and they can set up campgrounds and whatnot to allow access to the forest, does it not?
That would be encouraged. Recreational and educational uses of the forest would be encouraged. Access would be maintained at 100%, not 50%. So, yes, those types of things would be anything that could be used to for educational purposes, whether it's to generate an income for the school fund or to learn about forest management, would be greatly encouraged.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that I think is really fascinating about this plan is that it really sets up, it also addresses education so that we can go in and you'd have these Oregon College students and educators going in, setting up various studies where they could find out, you know, how the various wildlife populations thrive, the impact of recreational uses, all sorts of things. And why don't you address that a little bit?
Well, and don't forget about the third graders. Watching salmon spawn, watching
yes.
logging operations, monitoring it by remote sensing, as we can do now, digital video and so on, monitoring the income levels, seeing how the money's invested. Mm. These are all really good, excellent learning opportunities for a whole generation of Oregonians. So at the end of 20 years, if they decide to sell it, it would be as knowledgeable sellers.
Yeah.
Or if they decide to continue managing, they would have a real solid basis for management decisions, and then that would serve as a demonstration for our federal lands, hopefully.
Okay, and we've only got about 30 seconds here. Real quick, because there was only one bidder, does that impact this, or are they able to open it back up for more bids?
They can't open it back up. It looks like there's a fair chance that they're going to back out of the sale, and hopefully this proposal, the Elliott Educational Forest proposal, will be accepted and seriously considered as an option.
Okay, and if people want to help get this through, when is the next meeting for people to attend?
May 9th at 10 o'clock, that's the Oregon Land Board meeting. In the meantime, all decisions are made by the governor, the secretary, and the treasurer. So those would be the people and representatives for individuals to talk to before then.
Okay, great. Bob, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
The committee meeting for this is coming up fast this Tuesday. If you'd like to send them your thoughts on the sale of the Elliott State Forest, head to iSpyRadio.com and head to the Take Action page. Just look for that in the upper right-hand corner on the menu. And coming up, Ron Arnold. We'll be talking with him about George Soros, the man behind so much of what is wrong with America. I'd like to welcome now Ron Arnold. Ron is the Executive Vice President of the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise. He's especially known for his pioneering work on exposing the less funding. You can check out undoinfluence.com for just a taste of that. Ron, I want to thank you for joining us today, and welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what we're going to be talking about with you is George Soros. And in fact, this is such a full show that we've decided to break it into two different shows, this week and next. And George Soros is kind of, in many ways, he's sort of the Darth Vader. For those on the right, the Messiah, I guess, maybe for those on the left. But I just assume that most people know about George Soros. But then I have to remind myself that he wants to stay out of the public eye often, and the media will not cover him with the same amount of scrutiny as they do, say, the Koch brothers, simply because the Koch brothers donate to causes and candidates on the right, while Soros donates to those on the left, which, of course, much of the mainstream media favors. So I thought I'd give kind of a capsule description of him. George Soros was a Jew born in 1930 in Hungary. He lived through the Nazi occupation and, thanks to his wealthy father, was able to hide his birth from the Nazi occupiers by paying a Hungarian official to claim that he had adopted George. That official was given a job by the Nazis of going around and confiscating wealth from the Hungarian Jews before they were sent to the gas chambers for execution. After the war, Soros went to business school in London, getting a job from a fellow Hungarian at a bank in the UK, where he excelled at buying and trading currencies. He later moved to New York City, where he continued to trade currencies, famously making a fortune by short selling the British pound. Quote, he was known as the man who broke the Bank of England, boasting that he had made $1 billion in a single day in 1992 through currency speculation that drove down the value of the pound. He also started several hedge funds and eventually made billions of dollars through currency trading, hedge funds, and the like. He now uses that wealth to push his view of the world on the rest of us, especially through a network of foundations and nonprofit organizations, Open Society Foundations, MoveOn.org, and others. He hates Israel. He hates borders. He is all for one world government and new world order. George Soros hates organized religion. He hates nationalism. He promotes drug use, especially the so-called nonviolent drug users, and destroying societal norms and traditions. He spends millions every year to promote environmental causes that seek to destroy capitalism and industry. He spends millions more to support candidates that share his worldview. No, it's not all Democrats. Prominent Republicans have also taken Soros' cash, whether indirectly or through his fund managers, and have shoved it into their pockets as well. That includes John McCain, John Kasich, and Paul Ryan, among others. In summary, George Soros is the consummate globalist, with billions at his disposal to buy who and what he wants, and a complicit and mute media that willingly looks the other way at a swath of destruction, not just here in America, but across Europe, the Middle East, and nearly every part of the globe. Ron, did I miss anything important there?
No, that's a pretty good map, so let's go from there.
Okay. All right. Well, one of the things that, in reading your book, and I should mention that as well, it is, I think, one of the more fascinating books that you've put out there, and it is called Freezing in the Dark. And It is just, well, the subtitle of it is Money, Power, Politics, and the Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. And it really walks through Soros' evolution and some of these other organizations as well, detailing it with a huge number of notes to back it up. But as I was reading his story there through your book, he kind of comes across as the non-Nazi Nazi, where he, and in particular, he claimed in a 1998 interview on 60 Minutes that he had no remorse, no guilt at all about being a Jew and going around with the Nazis taking property away from Jews before sending them to the gas chambers, saying essentially because if he didn't do it, someone else would have. What do you make of that?
Well, that was more of an off-the-cuff remark than a genuine kind of a feeling of what he was actually doing at the time. He was scared out of his wits by them and just did what they did. He was a kid. He was like 12 years old.
Yeah.
And so what do you think he's going to do? He stayed alive. That's what he did. But when he got through, he got into a regime of communists because the Soviet Union, guess who took over? Hungary, of course. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's where he really began to hate governments that were very closed, just horrible. That was really where it came from. And he sort of looked at Hitler. Everybody knows Hitler, but they don't really know that much about the background of the Soviet Union. So he used that as a touchstone. Everybody understood it. But he really had somebody to hate, and that was the communists. And he essentially, and he's been credited by many people as being the person who actually began the fall of the Soviet Union, and piece by piece, he took it apart by giving them lots of money for things that they didn't particularly want people to have, like copying machines and different plays and books that were not Marxist. And he put 33 of the Soviet Union's universities on the internet, which is the last thing in the world they wanted. So it's a little bit more complicated, but he evokes Hitler because everybody in the United States knows who that was. But you can mention the name of about half a dozen, whoever read Vladimir Lenin. They have no idea what he wrote or anything like that. But he's the guy who started the Soviet Union. Anyway, so the whole thing amounts to, yeah, he's got a huge well of hate behind him. It was for a long time against what he called the communist threat. And when he got rid of that, it was an amazing thing that happened. He looked and saw that the democracy in the United States was so free and so open that it allowed trade everywhere in the world, and we were globalizing things, and he wasn't in front of it. Hmm. So he decided that he was going to do something about putting himself up front. And and this is very interesting, because he wrote an article in a very important magazine, and it called it The Capitalist Threat. And he said, well, yeah, I've made a lot of money in capitalist markets, but if you start taking capitalist values and put them in every part of your life, you just look at people as profit centers or employees or thing like that, then they're not free people anymore. And that's his big excuse. Well, it, like you mentioned, that he's doing exactly what he didn't want to do, and that is he's creating a world that is not open and a real world that is prone to violence.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, let's take a break there. Lots more with Ron Arnold talking about George Soros. Lots more to come. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Ron Arnold and talking about George Soros. Ron is the Executive Vice President of the Center for Defense of Free Enterprise. He is the author of 10 books and editor of 12 books. You can find all of those on Amazon.com. Just look for Ron Arnold. And but two of his books especially I'd like to talk about. Undue Influence, Wealthy Foundations, Grant-Driven Environmental Groups, and Zealous Bureaucrats That Control Your Future. And also the book Freezing in the Dark, Money, Power, Politics, and the Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. And especially Freezing in the Dark is the one that we're focusing a lot on today, which was very informative about George Soros and how he got his beginning, and really a lot of his early years were really quite fascinating. As we were talking about in that last segment there, he's very complicated in some ways. He grew up under Nazi regimes and has since then amassed a tremendous amount of wealth. And now it seems like he's recreating the world that he grew up under. I mean, he grew up at a time when one man, Hitler, sought to control the world and unify it under the Nazi flag. And now he is himself trying to do away with borders and bring the world all together once again under a single flag. I mean, does he not see the irony of that?
Well, he doesn't think that's what he's doing. Hmm. What he thinks he's doing is creating the open society all over the world, only he doesn't have a very good definition of the open society, and that is it's open to his views. He doesn't realize that what he's doing, he's essentially creating infrastructure for people on the left. And the problem that he's really having with it is he's not aware that anybody on the left, anybody to the left of, well, I don't know, I don't know how you could get farther left than Soros is now, but he did not start that way.
No.
He had a big transition because of actually it was George Bush and the war in Iraq. He thought that was not good. He particularly didn't like something that that Bush said, and that is, if you're not with us, you're with the terrorists. And that really struck Soros as being the echo of Hitler. Mm. And of course, now he's got all of this infrastructure that he's just all over the world, and it's amazing. I think people really don't, as you mentioned earlier, have any idea how big his empire is.
No.
And how many pies he's got his fingers in.
Yes,
but yes, he's definitely turning into what he didn't want to.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, and he certainly seems to be more than willing to sow seeds of chaos wherever he goes. Let's talk a little bit, kind of in an overall view, about his methodology. How does he go about accomplishing what he wants to get done?
He has this bizarre theory that he got from quantum physics, and you won't believe this, but he calls it reflexivity, and he believes that that's what makes bubbles in investments, where you go out and say, "Oh, I let it out that I bought a whole bunch of gold stock." And everybody starts buying gold stock. It goes up. He waits until it's at the top, and then he sells it all off, and it's worthless the next day. Well, that's essentially what he's doing with politics, and he does not realize that he's going to undo himself if he keeps on doing that. But he's doing that with all of the reasonably open societies, mostly Western Europe and certainly the United States, which is the openest of all of them, and that's what he says. He's putting all of this infrastructure together on the left and doing everything it can. And it goes in directions he's not particularly aware of, but probably wouldn't object to. And that is a lot of the things that we see in various protests. And we've seen it mostly in the rise of very socialist and some even communists. They call themselves that. That's not my name, but theirs. And his money is going there, although it's going through about five different filters. And the ones that he thought he was giving it to are giving it to somebody else, giving it to somebody else, and you get the idea. So if you give to the left, you really don't know where that money's going to go.
No.
Because the way things are set up legally, you have a 501c3, which is tax exempt and a wonderful thing. Hospitals and charities of all kind, then they can give some money very carefully to 501c4s, which are lobbying kinds of outfits and various kinds of activists, and they can give it to political action committees. Well, now Soros doesn't even bother doing that. He's got the c3s, c4s, and political action committees of his own that he started. So he's got the ammunition to do whatever he wants with the world, and he's doing it. And it's very difficult to tell whether or not a lot of the upset that we see today is really coming from anything he did or some of the huge infrastructure that he put together with dozens of others in his income bracket and the billion-dollar bracket. They're all doing it. And that's largely the work of Soros, because he's the guy who bankrolled a guy named John Podesta. And
yes.
You ought to talk about him sometime.
Well, yes. In fact, I do have questions about him. Let's go ahead and take a break a little early here, because the John Podesta discussion is going to take quite a bit. Everyone stay with us. We'll talk about that coming up next. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Ron Arnold and talking about George Soros, the Darth Vader for those of us on the right. Anyway, Ron is an author with a number of books under his belt there. Two of his more famous books are Undue Influence and also the book that led us into our discussion with George Soros here. It's Freezing in the Dark, Money, Power, Politics, and the Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. And of course, we'll link all that up on iSpyRadio.com. And so we left that last segment there talking about John Podesta. And one of the things that really impressed me about your book was how many names, and you wrote that in, I think, 2007, how many names that are very familiar to people today were very involved back in the 90s and the 2000s. And in fact, in some ways, John Podesta and Ickes kind of goaded, I think, Soros to getting involved in politics, because up until the George W. Bush invading Iraq, he was trying to keep his hands out of politics in some ways, wasn't he?
Oh, completely. He, in fact, there are quite a few of his people. I've talked to people who were on his staff during that time, which is how come I knew so much about him. They told me what really happened. Well, they essentially said they would go to him and say, hey, we, you know, the Democrats are, or the people on the left are really being trashed. And he would say, well, I don't look at it as my job is to help the Democrats or people on the left. He was just about as apolitical as you could possibly be as far as his own, where is he going to put his money at that time? Mm. Well, some things happened, and particularly the preemptive strike against Iraq really got him, because that reminded him of Hitler and his own background, and that turned him so that he began to think that it wasn't communism that was the threat. It was capitalism, and we were the biggest capitalists in the world. Okay, well, it just so happened that Ickes got the idea that the Democrats are going to lose the 2004 election if they don't do something about it. So they came up with this idea of creating a piece of infrastructure that would be a center for everybody on the left. And it was called, eventually, first it had a different first name, but and that was Center for American Progress. And that was, now, was what you'd have to understand something about Soros. He's very bizarre. He will change his mind on a dime. He was not even aware of the Center for American Progress. He didn't know who Podesta was, and he didn't want a thing to do with it. So what he did is he gave all of the notices that we're going to start this thing, and will you give me a bunch of money? He gave that flyer to a friend of his named Sandler, who had a big savings and loan outfit, and he was very wealthy out in California. And it was Sandler that went in there. Now this is kind of a vintage Soros, and that is he really wanted it to succeed, but it's like being an investor. You don't want to be the only investor. You want company. So he wants, if it's a nonprofit that he's going to put together, like Center for American Progress, he wants other people to pay for it. So he pledged $3 million, which he never did pay, and gave the Sandler this note, who actually went out to from California to D.C., and here he is in Washington, and he meets this guy. I think, oh, he's wonderful. He has these great ideas, and his values are so wonderful and sweet. He's a liberal, blah, 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 all of this kind of stuff. And he gave him a bunch of money. Well, about four or five donors down the line, Soros actually gave him $1 million and said, well, that's enough. Main thing is his part of his plan of action is get company. He wants other people to put their money into it, which is one of the reasons he is so powerful and one of the reasons that he's behind so many things. He's not the only one in the room. Yeah. There's a lot of other people there.
Yeah, and I think that's something that a lot of people end up missing, is that they kind of focus all of their attention on Soros. Meanwhile, there are dozens of other very wealthy, maybe not as wealthy as Soros, but exceptionally wealthy people pouring millions of dollars into this. And really, it seems like a lot of the focus of his organizational efforts is to kind of form the skeleton for a lot of these other foundations and whatnot. So they will set up the funding to get an organization going, which then provides support for all of these other organizations. Is that kind of a good capsule summary of what he does?
You couldn't have put that any better. That's perfect. In fact, this Center for American Progress is exactly that. When it was finally up and running, it became the echo chamber for a while, and then it actually became a conduit to the White House. When Obama got in there, Podesta, remember, was the campaign manager of both of Obama's campaigns. He's probably the most, even though, you know, you hate to say this about your political opponents, but he's probably the most intelligent politician in Washington as far as how to make things happen. And when he was in the middle of putting this Center for American Progress together, every time somebody got in trouble politically, he would hire them and for just a kind of a cushion, make sure introduce them to all of the other people with money. They went off with their money and formed their own organization. And there must be 50 to there may be even 100 different organizations that came out of John Podesta's Center for American Progress with then the whole thing came from a pledge of $3 million, which never showed up from Soros. And he got other people in there to do it. So Soros's plan for make everything possible on the left grow, he didn't even have to do anything except pledge $3 million and actually gave them $1 million. After a while, somebody else was in there.
And got the rest of it going. So, hey, we've only got about a minute here with you in this segment. Before we leave the subject of John Podesta, was he also involved somehow in taking down the Soviet Union?
No, he was not. He was absolutely no part of that. That was, in fact, almost nobody was aware of it until it was done. There was one of our ambassadors who knew him pretty well. And he said this famous quote, there is only one person in the United States who has his own foreign policy and can enforce it. That's Soros. So that'll tell you what an ambassador thought of him at that time. But no, Podesta wasn't even in that picture at all. I mean, he was strictly a kid from Illinois who got through law school and became a good politician in Washington.
Yeah. Well, he still certainly has his own fingers in a lot of pies. All right, let's take a break there. Everyone, stay with us. We'll wrap things up with Ron Arnold talking about George Soros after this. Welcome back. We're talking today to Ron Arnold. He is the Executive Vice President of the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, and we're talking about George Soros today, and we're actually going to be continuing this discussion next week as well. This week it's more kind of a general look at George Soros. Next week we'll be looking at some of the specifics of what he's got his fingers involved in, including some very interesting takedowns of other countries, their leaderships, and I know that he's very heavily involved with Macedonia. There's actually a lawsuit right now against him. So we'll talk about that next week. Before we leave this week's, though, I'd like to talk a little bit about how he really some differences from what I see from the left and the right in terms of how they get their organizations going. And from what I've seen, what is really different about the left versus the right when it comes to their nonprofit and organizing is this. A group on the right wants to form and get going. They are immediately seen as a competitor to the other organizations on the right, competing for time, especially donation dollars. The other organizations sometimes actually try to squash them. And if they do succeed against the odds, they very rarely work in cooperation with other organizations. They don't share resources, don't share membership lists, and the other organizations don't often share a lot of cash resources. And I'm thinking especially of a meeting that I was at where there was a representative from FreedomWorks and also one from Americans for Prosperity. And there was this effort going on to try to get these two organizations working together on the same page. But the representatives only agreed on one thing. They would not share resources and definitely would not share a mailing or membership list, not within the group and certainly not with each other. And really, they were there because they wanted that group to funnel them money rather than the reverse and to give money to the group to get going. On the other side, a group on the left wants to get going and form, and they are immediately welcomed and seen as an ally to the other organizations on the left. They are seen as a means to draw even more people to the cause and as a means to acquire additional donation dollars. The other organizations try to help them. They offer resources, money, leadership, experts, organizational assistance, especially as we talked about earlier with Soros. The other organizations manage to work in cooperation. They share resources. They often share members and also membership lists. And the other organizations will offer whatever help they can to help keep them going because they recognize that the entire force is more formidable with that additional organization. Why have just members from one organization testifying at a hearing or protesting against something when you can have members from dozens of organizations? Is that, again, a good encapsulation of what's going on between right and left?
Absolutely. It's only missing one thing, and that is who's responsible for that on the left. And that is an organization. It's very shadowy, but it doesn't try to hide itself, and it's called the Environmental Grant Makers Association. It came into existence when some foundation executives happened to be in Washington, D.C. for a conference and talked to each other over coffee about what their outfits were doing in the way of who are you funding? Well, we're funding so on. And they started out saying, no, well, we don't want to, we want to find that out because we want to duplicate your efforts. Well, then they started, they did that the next year. And they said, you know, we've learned so much about what we're doing. We ought to do this every year. And they did. And within two more years, it had turned into an organization of over 200 foundations that were all on the left, all about the environment. And their job was, by that time, to share everything they could with each other and to make the people they gave money to do the same. That's where that came from. And it was just trying to get people to do that on the right. People on the right are pretty certain that they know the right way to make things happen. And it's like the ideology gets in the way of cooperation. On the left, though they're ideological, all right, but there's so much on the left, and there are so many kinds of the left, they don't really care what the other guy thinks as long as it's somewhere on the left. And if you like this kind of education or that kind of environmental policy, we don't care. We just want you to get things farther to the left. So, yes, that that's exactly what happens.
Well, it reminds me of some of these mythologies where you've got all these little dragons kind of fighting with each other. And yes, they're formidable to the hero, but sometimes the dragons kill the other dragons. And it's kind of very disorganized versus the left, where it seems to be one giant hundred-headed hydra. And every time you cut off one head, two more appear.
Well, that's true. Now, as a matter of fact, that happened to this Environmental Grantmakers Association in the early 1990s. They got sick and tired of every one of their environmental group recipients taking their money and wasting it. This one didn't lobby, or that one didn't do anything. They just sent out new fundraising things for themselves. Didn't do anything that really started a big infrastructure, big network. And so they said, we're going to run it. So essentially what happened then was what's called the prescriptive grant making. That is, the money doesn't just come with, gee, have a good time. It comes with instructions. You are going to do this. We in the foundation are making the program, and you will perform it, or you'll never get another dime from anybody, because we know everybody, and they will just say goodbye to you.
Yeah, blacklisted.
Yeah, that really did happen. And the guy who is running the Rockefeller Family Foundation, that's one of about a dozen. It's not the Rockefeller Brothers or the Rockefeller Foundation, it's the Rockefeller Family Fund. That's the fourth generation, fourth and fifth, rather. But that's where that came from today. It's an enforce, you are going to do good things and make the network work, whether you want to or not.
Wow. Wow. Ron, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave things there, though. But just to tease people for next week, one of the things that drove me nuts was that not only does George Soros give money, billions of dollars, to these far-left organizations, but many of his organizations also get millions, tens of millions of dollars from the U.S. taxpayer as well. Just a little something to tease you with for next week, and we'll definitely talk about that and some of the other issues that George Soros has his fingers into. Ron, I want to thank you so much for your time, and we'll see you next week.
I'll see you then.
All right. Bye-bye. Trust me, you will not want to miss next week's show with Ron Arnold as we dig deeper into George Soros and some of his actual operations, including some of the more hidden aspects of what George Soros is up to, the things that the mainstream media will never, ever report on. Don't forget that if you want to weigh in on the sale of the Elliott State Forest, head to iSpyRadio.com. Look for the link to the Take Action page, which is in the upper right-hand corner. It is too late to submit testimony directly. However, you can submit that through a proxy. All of the details, including the Gezi plan, are there on the Take Action page at iSpyRadio.com. share those links, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.